Morning, counsel. This is the case of Davis versus Ritter. You may be seated. And we will begin today by introductions from the court and then acknowledgments of the attorneys participating. I am Mike Havikin, the Chief Justice. And now by seniority as to service on the court, the other members of the court will introduce themselves.
Good morning. I'm Lindsay Miller-Lerman, appearing by WebEx.
William Castle, morning.
Stephanie Stacy, good morning.
Jeff Funk, good morning.
Jonathan Papik, good morning.
And John Frydenberg.
Counsel, Mr. Wingem, are you here today?
I'm here, Your Honor.
Very good. Good morning to you. Mr. Walden, are you here?
I am.
Good morning to you. Counsel, while you are seated at your counsel tables, please keep your mask on if at all possible. When you are presenting to the court, please take your mask off so that we can hear and understand what you have to say. Do either counsel have any questions before we begin today? Very good. Then Mr. Wingem, again, good morning to you. You may approach and you may proceed.
May it please the court. I represent Betty Davis. She was injured on March 25th of 2014. She was struck by a car that did not have a driver, and apparently it had rolled from a convenience store parking lot and struck the vehicle that she was in. The owner of the vehicle was a Mr. Ritter, defendant in this case. The person who had parked the vehicle at the convenience store was Mr. Limpach. The vehicle was insured by Farm Bureau. Prior to suit, there were numerous discussions with Farm Bureau and the adjuster with Farm Bureau about the action, settlement negotiations, and so forth. As the statute approached, there was a discussion that suit was going to be filed, and suit was ultimately filed March 15th of 2018. The complaint named Mr. Ritter, who was the owner of the car, in the action. On April 10th of 2018, plaintiff's counsel received a call from defense counsel indicating that you got the guy that owns it, but not the person who had possession of the vehicle. Immediately, a new complaint was filed, an amended complaint, specifically citing section 25-201.02, the relation back statute for Nebraska, and naming Limpach as a party defendant. After service of the amended complaint, the defendants filed a motion to dismiss Mr. Limpach. Affidavits were prepared and accepted by the court in that motion and hearing for dismissal. Essentially, Mr. Limpach had indicated in his affidavit that the first time that he was aware of the suit was between April 10th and 12th of 2018. The court ultimately granted the motion to dismiss on June 22nd of 2018. In its order on page 2, the court stated, Limpach states he did not learn of suit until April 10th. It was requested that there be some kind of discovery or something to find out what Limpach knew and what the parties knew, since those affidavits were prepared by defense counsel, but court rejected that, and that might have been the end of the story. However, the case against Mr. Ritter went forward, and during depositions, Mr. Limpach testified that he learned of the suit before April 10th through conversations with Mr. Ritter. He confirmed this under questioning by his own defense counsel, indicating that there had been a conversation about the suit before April 10th, which was different from what he had stated in his affidavit. Mr. Ritter testified that he was aware of the suit March 19th, and that was in his affidavit, and that he did not talk to anybody about the suit after March 25th of that year. It's important that March 25th date is because that's the date the statute of limitations would have ran. So.
And what is the importance of Mr. Limpach knowing about the suit?
Well, I think it goes right to the whole point of section 25-201.02. He had actual notice and knowledge of the lawsuit prior to the statute of limitations. And in the Smeal case, it has, the court has indicated that, you know, service isn't the issue. The issue is whether or not you have actual knowledge of the suit that is going forward under that statute. So he essentially,
if I may interrupt, if we were to say that Mr. Limpach had knowledge of the existence of the lawsuit prior to the expiration of the statute of limitations, what is your best evidence that would say there's an inference that Mr. Limpach, prior to the expiration of the statute of limitations, knew that there was a mistake in the pleading of that law, initial pleading of the lawsuit? Mistakes such as Rutter's identified as the driver, Limpach's not named as either driver possessor. What's the best evidence there's an inference he knew of a mistake in the first complaint?
Yes, Your Honor. I think that the fact that he had had conversations with Mr. Ritter, and Mr. Ritter also indicates this, about the issues of liability from this accident. He was aware that he was the person in charge of that vehicle at the time, and that he had actually made sure that he was covered under insurance for this incident. So knowing that Mr. Ritter had been named, he certainly was aware that he was an appropriate defendant in this action.
Do we have evidence that Mr. Limpach would have known that there was an intent to sue the driver of the car?
I don't know if we have that, Your Honor.
So you're arguing that has to be inferred from the other evidence about a general conversation about the loss.
I think if you read through the actual statute itself, he would have known that he was the appropriate defendant from this accident. He's aware that there's a suit filed. He talks with Mr. Ritter. That was not provided in the affidavits for the, you know, original dismissal. And he's aware that he has the car. He even testified later that he thought he might have put the car in the gear wrong and that might have caused the incident. So he knows there's liability. He's worried about liability coverage. He knows that he would be the focus of the suit.
Are you arguing that Mr. Limpach knew there was a mistake, or that he should have known there was a mistake?
I would say that he should have known, Your Honor. I think that's a fair assumption.
Can you remind me on the record real quick? Was Mr. Limpach the named defendant in the suit on March 25th?
On the amended complaint, Your Honor?
Yeah, was he a named defendant?
Yes, he was.
On March 25th, he was.
Yes, he was. Yes, he was. Yes, it was substituted. The allegations against Mr. Ritter were substituted for Mr. Limpach.
I beg your pardon. I think the question from Justice Frydenberg was that on March 25th, which is approaching the end of the statute of limitations, had Limpach been named in the paperwork at that point?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Had Mr. Limpach been named as a defendant on March 25, not later, but on March 25, I believe that was the question.
Yes, Your Honor, actually the suit was filed March 15th.
At that time, Mr. Ritter was the only named defendant.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Mr. Limpach.
And so therefore, on March 25, Ritter was the only named defendant. Is that a correct statement?
As of March 25, Mr. Ritter was the only defendant in the case.
The statute of limitations would have run on what day?
March 25th, Your Honor.
I see. Was that a Sunday in that year?
I'm sorry?
Was that Sunday?
I don't know. I don't know.
So this is not necessarily a service issue?
No, it is not a service issue at all.
Thank you.
What it is, I believe, is the issue of 25201.02. And I believe, Your Honor, that the court in its second ruling recognized that it had incorrectly named its case a motion to dismiss because it went outside the pleadings. I think the court indicated in its motion for summary judgment that was filed later in the second opinion, while Ritter and Limpach may have talked about the lawsuit, the evidence clearly establishes that the discussions would have occurred after the statute had run. I don't think that's a fair assessment. I don't think the court, the underlying court, looked at the issues that relate to the statute. And I see my time is almost over. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. There's 53 seconds left. And I guess that's all I have at this point, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. Mr. Walden, good morning to you.
Good morning. Free of that, without taking my glasses completely off on the ground. May it please the court, my name is Ray Walden, representing both of the defendants, Mr. Ritter and Mr. Limpach. Of course, we started representing Mr. Ritter because he was the only one sued, and Mr. Limpach came in later, of course. The timing is important, not just of the basic dates, but also of what the evidence was about, the particulars of who knew what when, and especially because you have a suit coming in, there's a call from the insurer. Says, you know, you're being sued, you're the typical things. You know, service should be coming, look out for it, let us know. Then there's a, and at that point, the testimony is there's no discussion of the particulars of what the lawsuit was saying. The main particular, of course, is, Ritter, who is actually the owner, is being alleged that he was the driver who was negligent, which was not true, and that was changed later. Then at some undefined date in there, both of the defendants testify, Ritter let Limpach, the driver, know he's being sued about that thing, about 4 years ago, but there was no discussion, and this is their testimony, there was no discussion of the details, and there couldn't have been discussion of the detail about Ritter being misnamed as the driver because he didn't know yet.
That discussion happened before Mr. Ritter was served with a copy of the complaint?
Yes. It's somewhere in there. They were a little, not defining particularly, but, hey, I'm getting sued about that thing.
Tappick earlier asked your opponent about whether Mr. Limpach should have known. And how does that come into, if at all, come into the equation if someone should have known that they are potentially a party to a lawsuit?
Well, of course, the person in question is not a lawyer, so I don't think should have known would include being able to legally analyze the details of this. He wasn't told that he was misnamed. Okay, well, why are you suing this guy? There could be various reasons, that the driver isn't being sued, that the owner is. It made perfect sense in Iowa, but a Nebraskan wouldn't necessarily know about the limits on an owner's liability. We cite the Kollars case. Kollars versus Olson, in which it was the Court of Appeals, know, with a general contractor, was the actual contractor on this site was a joint venture. They sued one of the joint venturees instead, a corporation. The joint venture, the evidence had, the joint venture, of course, knew pretty much right away that this accident had happened, you know, on the construct or something blowing off the construction site. But they don't know that they weren't, you know, they don't know about themselves not being, you know, involved or, you know, being named as the joint venture that somebody else was. So then the lawsuit happens. I think that's a similar kind of thing. There is some other reason. There was the Rudd versus Deborah, and that was also the Court of Appeals 20 NEB App 850 in 2013. The son was the one who's intended to be sued. They served the father with the same name instead. Okay, then the statute passes. The son, of course, knew about the, you know, he's the one involved in this alleged assault. So he's thinking the father's being sued on something else, is what the evidence was. Well, should he have known that, you know, he was the one being sued, or the, who they intended to sue, and that it was about the assault? Well, the dad just said, hey, I'm being sued by that guy. And that was
Isn't it the undisputed fact in Rudd that the son knew of the incident at the arena or whatever it was, right? Everybody knew.
Definitely. Okay. Yeah, he of course knew of the incident, but he thought that the dad was being sued because of some business dealing with the dad's business. And why is he being sued? I don't know. Right. The dad didn't tell him that this is about an assault.
Right, but everybody knew there was an assault, and everybody knew that was the son that had been participating in the so-called incident, right?
And that's right. Nonetheless,
everybody, I beg your pardon, and so too in this case, everybody knows that Ritter is not the driver, right? Ritter knows that, Limpach knows that, but Ryder's got the insurance. Why not just sue the guy with the insurance?
That is a perfectly... Yeah, you know, good idea. Yeah, from Lundblock's viewpoint, well, okay, I was yeah, he thought that he would be covered by the insurance if he were sued, but he's seeing that, you know, that Ritter is being sued. I don't think that fits the statute on the should have known inside of the limitations period. And of course, Ritter didn't know about, you know, any of this, you know, him being, I mean, he knew about, he was served with a suit. He says he didn't at that point read it. You know, he's in communication with the law firm and being told don't talk to anybody, but then, you know, later on the insurance company tells Ritter, hey, can you let Mr. Limpach know that there's going to be an amended complaint and that he's going to be named this time? Now he knows, and it's, you know, quite a, you know, a few days, several days after limitations period has passed. This is the Ritter's first opportunity to actually tell Limpach, oh, they got it wrong. You know, we know you were the driver. Now they're finally suing you as the driver and so on. That was too late under the statute.
I beg your pardon at this point. This is a summary judgment that's in front of us, correct?
It's a summary judgment on the negligence of Mr. Ritter on the maintenance allegations. It's a reconsideration of the earlier ruling, taking into account, I mean, the judge actually took everything into account at this point, and
right.
That's
and so
fine.
Then the superseding order that we have in front of us by its terms is a summary judgment with respect to who's the driver, was Limpach notified within the statute of limitations, and in addition, it's a summary judgment on the roadworthiness of the car. So it's a summary judgment on both. Isn't that correct?
Well, yes, the judgment dismissing was on both.
Yeah.
Technically, he was reconsidering the earlier ruling. He was asked, can you reconsider this and now take this into account? And I believe that the judge said, okay, now I'm treating that as a summary judgment, not just a motion
to
dismiss.
Okay, so if the court were to treat these both rulings as summary judgments, what, in your view, are the inferences that within the statute of limitations, Limpach did or did not know Ryder was named as the driver, or should have known that Ritter was named as the driver. Not merely that Ritter was a named party. He's the guy with insurance. There's no surprise. But that Ritter was named as a driver within the statute of limitations.
There's no evidence that would support an inference that even Limpach should have known that that lawsuit against Ritter misnamed him. I mean, it, yeah, you're right. It could have been he was, well, why is he being sued? There's an explanation. You know, just like in these other cases, well, there's in the Deborah case, there is an explanation that was plausible to the son. Why is dad being sued? And then he finds out later, you know, that it's he's really trying to sue him for assault. And there was no amended complaint in that one. It came down on the basis of you know, more of a procedural thing about leave to amend, and it would have been futile to amend, you know, more narrowing in on the son, because he was actually named properly in the first place. But I don't want to get too deep in the weeds on that one.
Is the plausible explanation that Mr. Limpach might believe is that Ritter's being sued for negligent maintenance? Is that, I mean, if he's told that by Ritter that, hey, I'm getting sued for that thing with the car, oh, he's getting sued for negligent maintenance?
That could, you know, definitely that would be a good basis. I mean, we don't have anybody actually testifying about that level of detail, just about what did they know, when, and therefore could pass on to the other one when they were talking generally about, you know, there was a suit. Okay, well, what about the details? Because the statute makes you get into the details of what was known or, you know, should have been known about, you know, who is being named as the driver when it was the other guy who should have been named as the driver. And also I believe that, you know, I'll stand on my brief on the other part of this on the lack of any evidence that would support, you know, any kind of an inference on the negligent maintenance by Mr. Ritter.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal? 46 seconds, Mr. Winchin.
Thank you, Your Honor. Quickly, Your Honor, the Cutler's case that cited by the appellee, that involved a situation where there was no new complaint filed and there was or acceptance or allegation of notice. That's different from this case. Rudd, the court stated specifically the failure in this case is not in naming the right defendant, but failure to in not serving the correct individual who was involved in the incident described in the complaint. Different cases, different situations. Smeal is closest to this case. Smeal states, we agree the main purpose of the statute of limitations is to notify the defendant of a complaint basically without prejudice. I refer to page 908 of that case. I think the prejudice issue is what is involved here. That's all I have. Thank you.
Before you sit down,
yes, Your Honor.
Help me understand procedurally how your motion to reconsider the earlier dismissal morphed itself in to a summary judgment on the amended complaint against the additional defendant.
Mr. Limpach was dismissed in the earlier dismissal.
Right.
We still had a case against Mr. Ritter for the negligent maintenance. Counsel for the defense was kind enough to allow us to take depositions of both parties. We took those depositions. After the depositions of Mr. Ritter, defendants filed a motion for summary judgment. We filed a motion to reconsider as part of our resistance to the motion for summary judgment. The trial court agreed to accept the motion to reconsider without objection, and the court made its ultimate ruling after having done that.
What do you mean accept the motion to reconsider?
The court agreed to hear the motion to reconsider. It decided that it would reconsider the motion with the new evidence, at the same time recognizing that it had erred in calling the original case dismissal because we've gone outside the pleadings.
What the court did was treat the original motion to dismiss as a motion for summary judgment, and you brought in additional evidence, and everyone was okay with that.
Yes, Your Honor.
All right.
Yes, and if you read the court's ruling, I think the court does set that out, that there is no objection to the court reconsidering its earlier motion. All right. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you very much, counsel. This obviously concludes arguments on Davis versus Ritter, so you are excused. Please, if you can, properly social distance on your way out of the courtroom and wear those masks if at all possible, and please leave by the side door over here to what's left. Thank you very much. The court will go on to the next case of the day, which is Travis versus Lamb.